From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Secretary of State Bill Gardner is going to have some competition for his job for the first time in years. The challenge comes from former gubernatorial candidate Colin Van Ostern. For the second year in a row, we get a ton of snow on town election day, and students walk out to urge lawmakers to act on gun legislation. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them in this hour. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Gary Reno of InDepthNH.org, and NHPR's own Dan Tuohy and Casey McDermott. Thank you very much for being here, everybody.
Thank you.
Good morning, Peter.
Again, the phone number for you to call to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. And we're going to start by talking about Colin Van Ostern and his challenge to Secretary of State Bill Gardner. He announced this week that he's going to make a run for Secretary of State, which would require unseating Bill Gardner, who's held the position for more than four decades. Casey McDermott, you've been reporting on this. Why does Colin Van Ostern want this job?
So he has several kind of differences of opinion in how the Secretary of State should run his operation. I think that it's fair to say that a lot of this is being driven by the discontent that we've seen over the last year, stemming from Secretary of State Bill Gardner's involvement on the Trump administration's now defunct Election Integrity Commission, as well as his decision to share New Hampshire voter data with that commission. Both of those decisions drew a lot of outcry and I think a lot of attention to that office that typically I think operates largely kind of under the radar. They, you know, they're in the news whenever there's an election or a presidential primary or something like that. But for the most part, in between election cycles, it's very rare for the Secretary of State's office to get the amount of attention that it has been in the last year or so. So I think that spotlight in and of itself put it under a little bit more scrutiny than usual. Beyond that, Colin Van Ostern says that there's just room for more kind of transparency, more forward thinking in how the office is run, whether that's, you know, advocating for modernization of various types of voting technology or being a little bit more kind of like forward thinking on how they keep track of business filings, things like that. And I think it's interesting because I think you really could not have asked for two more kind of different styles in how these two men approach their position or approach campaigning.
Yeah, how would you describe
those
styles?
So, I mean, you know, Secretary of State Gardner has been in his position for more than 40 years. He's the longest serving Secretary of State in the nation. It's actually interesting. I spent some time yesterday going through some newspaper clippings from when he first sought the position, and he actually ran on a platform of reform. He came into the legislature as a very eager young lawmaker who spent a lot of time on election law. He sought to pass laws that addressed, you know, kind of hurdles that people ran into when they were registering to vote. He wanted to make the Secretary of State's office more responsive, more communicative. He wanted them to communicate more with town clerks across the state. And here, you know, 40 years later, you have someone else who is young, who's an up-and-coming politician, who says that, you know, he could do it better. But in terms of the campaigning, Secretary of State Gardner, you know, says he's never had a PAC, never had a fundraising committee, never asked for a dime of support from people in terms of financial support, and really relies on his personal relationships that he's built through the years in his position and all of the respect that he's built up over that time. Colin Van Ostern, meanwhile, has launched a political committee that, as of last filing, has already raised something like $45,000. That's a lot of money in any legislative race, let alone, you know, a race for Secretary of State. And he's really approaching this like a political campaign. He's going to put money into legislative races to support candidates that he says support his agenda. And then, you know, with the hopes that they will turn around and make a decision to back him instead.
Well, this is an issue that we'd love to hear from listeners on. What do you think? Is it time for a change in the Secretary of State's office? Do we need someone new in that position after 40-plus years of Bill Gardner? Or is this just a case of political opportunism on the part of Colin Van Ostern? Or something else? We'd love to hear from you. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Gary Reno.
Well, I think, you know, Casey said it was last year, but I mean, this has been building. Democrats have been grumbling about Bill for quite a while. It has to do with like the photo ID law, the affidavit law, the laws that were vetoed when they were passed by the legislature before when we had Democratic governors. But now we don't have a Democratic governor. And now we're seeing a full blown kind of attempt to decide who can vote and who can't vote. The other thing is she mentioned is this whole thing with the electronics and is Bill behind the eight ball. And if you remember last couple of years ago, they were trying to Manchester was trying to get electronic poll books in, and he fought it tooth and nail, made a lot of enemies in Manchester because of that. But the other side of this is, I mean, Bill's been in power for a long time, and a lot of people have taken shots at Bill, including people like Donna Sitek, and they've all lost. The most recent person to take a real shot at him was Jeanine Forrester when she was a senator, and she tried to take the Health Trust organization, which is the New Hampshire Municipal Organization's health care arm, and move it in from his office into the insurance department. And she thought she had it nailed, but when it came down to the nitty-gritty, Bill ended up getting his way and keeping it where it was. So he's a formidable opponent. And what's going to be really interesting is you have a Democratic caucus and a Republican caucus in December. And each one can put up a nominee for the Secretary of State. Obviously, it looks like the Democrats have already decided they're not going to put up Bill Gardner. They're going to put up Colin Van Ostern. You got the Democratic leader in the Senate and the House both backing Colin. What are the Republicans going to do? Are they going to put up Bill Gardner? It'd be very interesting.
I think it's you know, as Gary alluded to, you know, I think it's fair to say that a challenge to Secretary Gardner is rare, but it's by no means unprecedented. And we've seen a lot of talk in the last week since Colin Van Ostern made this announcement that he is politicizing the office or that he's, you know, taking an undue shot at Gardner because, like, by nature of simply challenging him. But if you look back, you know, there have been challenges, as Gary said, Donna Sitek when she was chairwoman of the Republican Party. So that in and of itself, that was a party chairperson who was challenging Gardner for the position. In the mid-90s, we had, I believe, a representative at the time, Myron Steer, who is in Swansea right now, and I think on the school board out there, who challenged Gardner on the grounds that he felt that there was a lot of room for reform in how the office was run. So this is not the first time that something like this has happened, but it's really the first time in recent memory that there's been a, you know, a real concerted effort to unseat him.
And before we go too far into this conversation, I want to hear from the man himself, Secretary of State Bill Gardner. Casey, you spoke with him earlier this week, and here's how he attempted to draw a contrast between himself and Colin Van Ostern.
When I first ran for the position, I never took a contribution. I never asked for any donations. I said I would not use this office as a stepping stone for higher office. I would do the job here, and I would do it in a way separating the political fray outside from in here.
That's Bill Gardner speaking about how he differs from Colin Van Ostern. Dan Tuohy.
Yes, I mean, one thing we have to look back here. He's been in office for 42 years, as Casey's reported here. But he was also a former three-term state rep from Manchester. And really, when you look at the numbers, every 2 years he's been on the ballot in some form or another. So he's really the most successful politician in the modern history in that sense. Granted, the past 42 years he's been running for one of the constitutional officer positions. But it's really remarkable when you look at how many times he's been up for a vote.
And Dean?
Yeah, it was interesting just hearing that clip from Secretary Gardner where he said he wanted to separate out the office from the political fray. You know, his intentions may have been honorable, but I'm still perplexed at why he thought participation in the sham Voter Integrity Commission set up by the Trump administration was the way to go if that was his intention. And then to actively support SB 3 and HB 372 on restrictions on residency and domicile, both of which are, well, actually, there's a substitute bill for HB 372, but these are all issues that are going to be litigated in court as potential civil rights violations in terms of restricting the vote. So I've we've talked about this many times on the roundup. I've been incredibly critical of that Voter Integrity Commission. It imploded, as I predicted. And for Secretary Gardner to think that participating in that commission was a good way to separate out the office from the political fray, I just don't understand it. And I think there's tremendous anger among Democrats in New Hampshire over his participation in that commission. They found it, they thought it was an embarrassment. And then to consistently push, as Gary suggested, for some of these restrictions on ballot access, he may say he wants to separate out the political fray, but for whatever reason, he seems to be in the middle of it. You know, whether or not Colin Van Ostern is the appropriate person to challenge him, I'll leave that up to the legislature to decide. You know, my guess is Republicans, given a choice, would go with Gardner if there isn't some other option. They've been attacking Van Ostern on social media pretty relentlessly since he announced this. But, you know, Colin's going to need to build up support in the state legislature. He's going to need to get Democratic seats back into the state legislature. If it's a Republican majority next year, again, it's not likely his challenge is going to win. So this is a whole strategy. I think what is surprising to people is this sort of that it's Van Ostern and that there's this whole strategy about, you know, filling Democratic seats through a PAC, et cetera, not so much that somebody is challenging Gardner. I think that you could have predicted given the anger among Democrats in the state.
Let's go to the phones. And if you would like to weigh in on this conversation about Secretary of State Bill Gardner and his being challenged by Colin Van Ostern, former gubernatorial candidate, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Hal in Pelham. Hal, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Thank you. I'm a selectman in Pelham, and I've been tracking Billy for quite a few years. I would point out his reform. He opposed a simple change of legislation that would randomize how candidates were listed on the ballots. Instead of always being from A to Z, it would be a random number. He opposed that. He opposed a recent thing where we tried to speed up the processing of voters to the polls by using some electronics. It was supposed to be a sample test, which is many states use, and he successfully opposed that. And then I would point out, if you look at a recent court case of Roger Couto versus Secretary of State, he cost the state a couple hundred thousand dollars because of his actions. So, and there's several other things I can mention, but to me, he is not in for meaningful reform. And I think he's also, from a town point of view, he's cost that town some money.
Well, Hal, thank you very much for calling in and giving us your insights. We appreciate it. Let's also talk to Bradford in Manchester. Hi, Bradford. Thank you very much for calling.
This is Brad Cook. I'm head of the Ballot Law Commission, and Secretary Gardner is our clerk. And I just wanted to call and say that he does a spectacular job protecting New Hampshire elections. He's been very cautious about changes that might jeopardize the integrity of votes. He's been an excellent Secretary of State. And even though sometimes we don't vote with him and sometimes we vote with him, as a ballot law commission, there's absolutely no reason to change him.
Bradford says no reason to change him. Thank you very much, Bradford. Appreciate your call. Casey McDermott?
Well, I think the caller from Pelham hit on something else that's important to note, is that it's not just a matter of people being, some of the discontent isn't just stemming from Secretary Gardner's positions on legislation affecting voting, voter registration or his involvement in the Trump Commission. But Gary alluded to this before. There's also been some tension between him and local election officials who feel that he's not been appropriately communicative or cooperative in some of the changes that they've been calling for. We saw earlier this week the kind of sequel to last year's Blizzard Town Election Day that renewed a fair amount of discontent among local election officials who were really upset that Secretary of State Gardner has taken the position and has been backed up by the Attorney General's office that local towns do not have the authority to make changes or postpone their town elections in the event of a blizzard or otherwise. A lot of people feel like that's a violation of local control. Secretary Gardner and the state say, look, we can't have 100 different town election days. We need some consistency. We also need to guard against towns who might go rogue and try to make changes for, suspicious reasons because they want to affect the outcome of certain ballot measures. But I think that it's important to note that there's a lot of different aspects to the job simply beyond the kind of, presidential primary or the elections that we have every 2 years. There's also managing that relationship between the Secretary of State's office and, the towns that they act as a resource for. And I think there's been some, a little bit of a deterioration of trust in that way over the last few years as well.
Feeling that deterioration of trust was Kevin Smith, Londonderry town manager, who Londonderry, by the way, one of the more than 70 towns that delayed voting last year during the big snowstorm. This year we had a repeat, but the state, as you mentioned, Casey, said towns can't do that. Kevin Smith of Londonderry town manager, he was pretty upset with that. And he spoke about it with me earlier this week on All Things Considered.
On one hand, you want to get a good turnout for a municipal election. On the other hand, you want people to be safe. Kind of a juxtaposition when you've got the state on one hand is going to be telling people, stay off the roads, let the emergency crews do their thing, don't put yourself in danger. But on the other hand, they're saying, oh, but get out and vote. It really kind of defies common sense, in my opinion. And it's unfortunate they're not letting the towns make that decision on their own.
Londonderry town manager Kevin Smith speaking about how he's pretty upset with the state's decision to not let towns reschedule town election days because of the snow. Certainly, it's difficult to get to polling places when there's 18 inches of snow on the road. We have a comment from Tom in Exeter who says, a question, is Colin Van Ostern in favor of allowing towns to decide whether to postpone March town voting in case of inclement weather? So do we know if Colin Van Ostern would go a different way?
So he actually, one could say that the timing of his announcement was well-timed given the storm and all the discontent that we mentioned earlier. At the beginning of his announcement, which was on Wednesday, so the day after that snowy town meeting day, he actually started off by addressing that issue and said that, if he were chosen to serve, that he would work with towns to avoid the confusion and to make sure that, they had local control to, exercise over that decision. So I think the interpretation there being that he would have handled it differently.
Just as an aside, it was really interesting that one of the newspapers ran a list of how much snow had been received on town meeting day every year for like the last 20 years. And it's typically, 1 inch, 2.5 inches. And then the last 2 years, it's these massive snowstorms.
Yeah. Gary.
Well, I mean, in my many years ago when I was a reporter for a weekly newspapers in New Hampshire, and I used to cover town meetings from one end to the other and to the point where I can't stand to go to them anymore. But I don't know how many Tuesday nights it would be just a horrible snowstorm and you'd have to get out there and get the votes. And I mean, this isn't new. This has been going on for years and years and years. And more often than not, there was an awful storm on a town meeting night, and you just have to get through it.
Wow. Well, there is a bill in the legislature, right, that's seeking to sort of provide some kind of remedy for this. Casey, what would that bill do?
Yeah, so the proposal that is on the table right now, it actually was just passed by the Senate last week, would provide a mechanism by which towns can ask the Secretary of State for permission to postpone their elections, or the Secretary of State's office on their own could, make some kind of determination about delaying elections after consultation with, weather officials, emergency management officials, and that could be used either for the purposes of weather delays or also just some kind of other, public safety concern. That did pass last week, although over the objections of the Municipal Association and a group of senators who introduced an amendment to defer to towns to give them the ultimate authority. So it really, at the heart of this is a debate over who should have the final say in the scheduling of local elections. The Secretary of State's office says, their position is that they oversee elections. There needs to be some kind of check on towns to make sure that there's no kind of malfeasance there. Towns say, look, we know our communities best. We should be able to make that decision on our own.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and coming up on the show, a discussion about the state's death penalty. The New Hampshire Senate voted to repeal the state's death penalty this week, but the governor has promised to veto the death penalty repeal bill should the state put certain convicted criminals to death. Is the punishment an effective deterrent in your view? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange at nhpr.org. Let's talk a little bit about what happened on Tuesday's town election day, especially with respect to Keno, because several towns voted on whether or not to allow Keno in their towns. Several of them, in fact, the majority of them passed, right? They passed Keno.
Dan
Toohey.
I believe it was 36 towns. Some town meetings, it will be acting on it later this week or later this spring even. But, 36, I believe, out of 45 that had it up for a vote so far have approved it, allowing the Keno gaming in their towns. There, I believe, were 9 towns, Peter, that rejected it. In Newberry, they rejected it 110 to 110. So it was a tie vote. Didn't make the simple majority for passage. But it sounds like they will have a recount there for people that want to support that as well.
Mm-hmm. It's in one of the articles that I read about this is that Charlie McIntyre, the director of the lottery, said they are anticipating earning $500 per store per day for these towns that implement Keno. Pretty good incentive for these towns, I guess, right, to have Keno?
Well,
I mean, it's money going to the state. It's not going to these towns per se, you know. And it's not really a store. It's mostly bars and restaurants.
Yeah, restaurants. As a matter of fact, I was going to say, just by accident, I ended up in a restaurant over the weekend, not knowing that it had Keno. And I walked in, and there were these big screens everywhere, and you could fill out a ticket right at your table. And I looked around me, and lots of people were playing. And so it looks like it's something that would do reasonably well in the state for towns that adopt it.
Were you tempted, Dean, to try it out?
I thought about it, but I was like, well, maybe
on,
next
do it
time.
For the
yeah, it's, it basically looked like right.
It basically
looked like a sort of a high tech version of bingo.
There is a novelty factor here as well. I mean, it's new. Charlie McIntyre, who used to work for the Mass Lottery, knows very well. We had a lot of players in New Hampshire go to Mass to play Keno. So in the southern tier, especially Manchester, Nashua, Salem, of course, is a very great gambling history in Salem with The Rock. They endorsed Keno as well this week.
Yeah, I grew up in Massachusetts, and I remember going to the mall, and my mother would let me and my brother run around the mall while she sat on a bench and played Keno at the convenience store at the mall. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're speaking with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and author of the website NH Political Capital, Gary Raynow of InDepthNH.org, NHPR's Dan Toohey, and NHPR's Casey McDermott joined us for this segment. Thanks very much, Casey, for joining us.
Thank you.
You can call us with your questions about the week's news, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange at nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Everyone could do with a bit of Irish luck now and again, which is why you should support NHPR today. When you do, you'll get not one, but two chances to win a trip to Dublin, Ireland, courtesy of Milne Travel American Express. That's two chances to see the brilliant Cliffs of Moher, stroll through St. Stephen's Green, or drink in some knowledge at the Old Jameson Distillery. The lucky winner will be picked on St. Paddy's Day, but you can increase your odds now with your gift today at nhpr.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, NHPR's Dan Toohey, and reporter Gary Raynow of InDepthNH.org. Call us now with your questions about the week's news. In a moment, we're going to be talking about the bill to repeal the death penalty in the state of New Hampshire. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, that's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. The state Senate passed a bill this week to repeal the death penalty in the state of New Hampshire. Gary, who's behind this legislation?
There's a number of people behind it, which is rare. Well, I think a good number of the Senate, Republican and Democrats, were sponsoring this bill, which is really rare because the Senate has traditionally been the block to this repeal of the death penalty. It's passed the House a number of times, rarely passes the Senate. particularly, I think this is the first time it's passed the Senate when Republicans have had control of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of Senate Republicans that were sponsoring this bill. So it was a 14 to 10 vote. And it was a bipartisan vote.
Yeah. So, Dean, why have the political winds shifted on this?
I think it mirrors a change you've seen around the country with DNA testing and other flaws in the process by which people are condemned to death. And you've seen a number of states look to roll back the death penalty. The issue of whether or not to have a death penalty seems to kind of go in these sort of larger cycles in our country. You know, New Hampshire is in an interesting situation. You know, we don't really have a death row. We have one individual waiting who's been condemned to death, but we haven't actually executed anyone since 1938 or 39. So it'd be very expensive to actually have to build the infrastructure to do this. I think Governor Sununu has said he would veto it. You would need 2/3 in each chamber of the state legislature to override him. I think, and Gary, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that Gene Shaheen was the last one to veto a repeal in the late 98 or 99, something like that. So we've been down this road before. But I think there has been this sort of larger change in terms of beliefs about the efficacy. And, you know, in the this isn't necessarily directed at New Hampshire's case, but more broadly in the country about how effective it is. But we have the other issue of we haven't really done this in, 70, 80 years. And to try to do it now is problematic.
Right. And previous bills, this has been tailored to so it wouldn't affect Michael Addison, who's on death row for the killing of Michael Briggs, Manchester police officer. As Dean mentioned, the last hanging, it was a hanging right up here in Concord at the state prison, 1939, Howard Long. And I recall from all the debates we've had over the years, Gary, the rope that was part of that hanging is on display at the Belknap County Sheriff's Office, right?
I believe it is. Yeah.
It's a debate that comes up every session. It's very powerful debate on either side, including yesterday or this week from Lou D'Alessandro, a Democrat from Manchester, pointing out we need this as a deterrent, even if it stops one murder or capital murder from occurring.
Mm-hmm. Regarding Michael Addison, though, I want to point out at least today in the Union Leader. Someone mentioned that, in every state where the death penalty has been repealed, those who were sitting on death row at the time have not been executed. There's not been an execution in a state where this has been repealed. So those who say, oh, this is not going to affect Michael Addison, there has been some doubt cast on that. Gary, have you heard anything like that?
That's been said before. I mean, this came up a couple of years ago and they tried to tailor it. I mean, it was pretty obvious that in other states where this has happened, that they have, people who are on death row basically
I think in New Hampshire it's tailored to killing police officers, first responders, things like that.
Judges.
Mm-hmm. So not entirely confident that there's enough power to override the governor's veto in this room.
There won't be.
Okay.
The Senate didn't vote enough. They need 16 votes. They only got 14.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting to see that the guy who has really pushed this over the years, Rennie Cushion, whose father was killed by a police officer, he is just sort of beside himself because the Senate has been the last, I think, three or four times that it's come through past the House. It's died in the Senate. Some of them were tied votes, but it has died there. And so he's really excited. The question is the House going to be?
Right. And Rennie Cushing's, the representative Cushing's father was killed by an off-duty police officer as well. That's the thing we heard, some of the debate, the passionate debate of, he didn't realize how many people had a loved one who was murdered or died of a case like this. So that's what I mean. It's so emotional debate, and it has been every 2 years.
Well, make the connection for me between Rennie Cushing's personal experience and his position on the bill. I mean, was he advocating for some kind of global forgiveness for the man who killed his father? Was that the idea, that he didn't want to commit this person to death, but rather see him in jail forever?
He used to be the executive director of the Murder Victim Rights Association or Families regionally. He's like, it's not going to bring his father back. It's something to that effect. But, obviously he's very clear on his desire to have the death penalty abolished.
Mm-hmm. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Give us a call to join the conversation or ask a question about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Students across the state walked out of their classrooms on Wednesday, which was 1 month after a young man with a gun walked into a Florida high school and killed 17 people. Dan, what were these students hoping to achieve by walking out of school on Wednesday?
Well, many well-spoken young men and women, students from Concord, Conway, Portsmouth, or in Hanover, or did it last week because they're on break this week. They're trying to be heard, and some were saying, you want to be here out of solidarity. Some mentioned they were just frustrated with, here we have another school shooting. And some were very, very political, saying, drop your guns. My life's more important than protecting or opposing restrictions on the Second Amendment.
Mm-hmm. And among those students that spoke and attended this walkout was John McDevitt in Portsmouth. He, along with Portsmouth High School students, gathered in Market Square downtown in Portsmouth to protest these school shootings.
I don't know if this group of kids is going to change something just by coming out here today, but I know that nothing's going to happen if we stay in our schools. And I know that, I'm 17. I don't know what I can do, but I know that I can do this.
Not sure what he can do, but he can walk out of school and apparently draw some media attention. Gentlemen, any of you know if lawmakers, either locally or nationally, have made a substantive response to what these students are doing?
Well, we had Governor Scott in Florida sign some legislation as a result of what's happening in Florida. But, the challenge with gun reform has been that we have these cycles of a tragedy followed by an uptick in the national discussion about reform, and then it sort of gradually fades over time. And I think there's a concern among these students that that's going to happen again. We've already seen President Trump back away from any significant restrictions on gun ownership to focus more on arming teachers and school security and mental health. The challenge for these students is the only way you're going to get any significant change is to have a different set of legislators in there who support your position. So you need to vote. And, some of these kids are 18, a lot of them are not. So it may be the kind of change that comes slowly over time if they can keep the visibility up. And I think that's the big challenge. We've got this big national march coming. I think it's next week. That will increase visibility, but is it 20-something next Saturday. Saturday? Yeah. So it's a challenge. There hasn't been much success in the past in the current political climate, but we'll see what they can do. But doesn't seem to be any major change coming from the Trump administration in terms of the focus on actual gun ownership. They're willing to do things on mental health and strengthening schools. I mean, this sort of mirrors Governor Sununu's position. He has his task force is mainly focusing on school safety and mental health and things like that, and not really on actual changes to the gun laws.
Just to mention, there are more rallies coming up on March 24th. There's going to be a rally in Washington and on April 20th, which would be the anniversary of the shootings at Columbine High School in Colorado. There will probably be rallies on that day as well. Dan Tuohy?
I think it will. And I think, it's really fascinating to watch the activism of these young people. You wonder whether, as Dean mentioned, it will continue. These men and women are they're the young people, the kids. On one hand, whether they stick with it. And, not just Parkland, some of the tape we just rolled there, some really well-spoken 17-year-olds, where will this come? That's part of their frustration, is they want to get out here and be heard, but also do it, have some results,
Mm-hmm. Gary, go ahead.
I think we're seeing something we haven't seen for a long time. We have to almost go back to the 60s where you had the uprising over the war and the draft, the same sort of movement where you had all these young people coming together. I mean, then you were worried about going to Vietnam. Now you're worried about being in school. It's certainly a change.
Mention that, there was a Second Amendment gun rights rally at the State House last weekend. So that they're obviously very vocal in support of maintaining the Second Amendment rights here in New Hampshire and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And also along the lines of guns and gun legislation, the State Senate Education Committee voted 3-2 along party lines on Wednesday, that same day as the walkout, to reject a proposal that would allow school boards to impose gun-free zones on school property. Gary, who is behind this?
Senator Hennessy from Hanover. She had proposed this. In this state, the legislature has the sole authority to pass any sort of gun legislation. However, we also have the idea of local control, and that's what she was aiming at. Local school boards should know better what's going on in their community than having the state legislature decide whether we have gun-free zones or not. And unfortunately, this has gotten to be a very partisan issue. It's Republicans are for Second Amendment, if you will, and Democrats are for greater restrictions on gun ownership. So it's really been kind of a sorry state of affairs for quite a while, and it's not changing any. And this whole debate hasn't moved past that, even though the students are out there, you know, clamoring for some change.
Mm-hmm. Gun-free zones, I guess, not in the offing for schools. Yeah. Also on Wednesday, the governor's School Safety Preparedness Task Force met. Among other things, the governor wants the task force to look into the effectiveness of arming school employees. Of course, I want to stress that's not all this task force is doing. But Dan, what's the overall goal of this task force?
It's a very lofty goal. I mean, the governor, as he said in his State of the State address last month, you know, looking at continuing some of the work they've already done in terms of improving school security, including surveillance cameras and, you know, locked doors and such, which, you know, it's bricks and mortar, but it's very important, we've seen. That'll be part of this review as well. And as the governor mentioned, he sat down. It was the very same day as that vote on the 3-2 for the school issue, the same day as the walkout at Concord High School. So all these issues were bubbling up to the top. And this, you know, school safety task force will continue. And I suspect it's going to be a broader report. And some of the members include, you know, Perry Plummer, Chief of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. So they have some well-known experts on there that are continuing to review and dig down. But it won't necessarily be about proposed, quote-unquote, gun control.
We did hear from Governor Sununu about this meeting, or actually at this meeting. Here's Governor Sununu warning that New Hampshire is not immune to the possibility of a school shooting.
We've been very fortunate here in the past few years in that we haven't had a significant incident dealing with a shooting. But we all know that that day could come, and the best thing we can do is be as prepared as possible. What we do today can define saving lives down the road.
Governor Sununu says attempt to save lives down the road. Gary.
Well, I mean, even the day, a couple of days after the shooting in Florida, we had threats at high schools here. Nothing became of them. They were sort of caught before it got very far, but I mean, we have it here, so we're not immune from it, that's for sure. However, this being Sunshine Week, the media likes to see a little light spread on government.
Sunshine Week, for those who aren't steeped in media, it's a time when reporters celebrate the ability to bring documents that are public out into the sunlight. Sunshine Week.
And this task force that the governor is put together, he asked reporters to leave after they did the introductions. He said, we want to have a closed-door meeting. And he asked other people, he told people that we're going to have a lot of closed-door meetings so people could freely express themselves. He didn't say don't talk to the press, but he said if you talk to the press, just give them your opinion and nobody else's. I think this is an important enough issue that there really ought to be a lot of transparency here. And to be closing these meetings is not a good thing, and it's not a right way to go, I don't believe.
Is he concerned about, and this is just speculating, is he concerned about the members of this task force grandstanding their political opinions on the part of the press who might be watching?
He was talking about wanting to make sure that we could freely express our opinions without without the media watching. Mm-hmm. It's basically what he was saying, which is kind of the opposite of that.
Okay. So, what's your argument, Gary? Why should these be open?
Because I think people ought to know where these people stand. They ought to know what's going on here and what's being done in their name. This is a public task force.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're speaking with our guests about the week's news. Coming up later in the program, the fate of Christina Fey in the hands of a jury. She, of course, was accused of animal cruelty after dozens of Great Danes were seized from her Wolfboro mansion. Give us a call to weigh in on this or something else you heard in the news this week. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. All right, let's talk about Northern Pass, Gary. You've been covering this for indepthnh.org, and you reported this week that any decision regarding Northern Pass's application to build its transmission line will have to wait until May. Why are they going to wait?
Well, they went in there, and we should backtrack here a little bit.
Okay.
The SEC last 1st of February decided that it was going to deny the application. And Public Service, or Eversource as it's known now, asked to have them reconsider it. And by the state, the rules of the SEC and administrative rules, they had 10 days to make a decision. So they could go in and they could deny it, the motion to reconsider. They could approve it, or they could suspend their decision, which is what they did. When you suspend a decision, there's nothing to appeal. So you can't really, so you don't have to vote on it. So what they did was saying, we're going to wait, which is what everybody expected them to say, until we have a written decision, and then you can ask for a rehearing. Because when you have a motion to rehear or to reconsider, you're supposed to say where the decision was wrong legally or so on and so forth. And that was never the case. When they have an oral decision, it's hard to do that. So they said, you can do that. We have until the end of the month to make our decision. You'll have 30 days after we put out our written decision. And then people opposed to your motion will have 10 days. So if you do the math, it takes it out into May, to about mid-May before they're going to decide on this. The problem being for Northern Pass that they have until March 27th to reach a negotiated settlement with the distributors in Massachusetts for the Clean Energy Project. Which is, they are the chosen one to do that, but the people in Massachusetts are also negotiating with the Central Maine Power. So it doesn't help them in that respect at all.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask, what does this mean for Massachusetts? Now I guess they're keeping their options open, it sounds like.
They're basically keeping their options open.
Yeah, okay. Gary, from your perspective, does it seem like Eversource is going to just appeal every chance they get, if they get the chance?
Well, they are, and I mean, the opponents are going to do the same thing if it goes the other way. This is a long ways from being decided one way or the other. And beyond the SEC, it goes to the courts. I mean, it can go up to the federal courts after they go through the state courts. So we're a long ways from any kind of real decision here.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're speaking with Gary Reno of InDepthNH.org, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and the author of the website Political Capital, and NHPR's Dan Tuohy. Coming up after the break, we're going to talk about Christina Fey. We're going to talk about the winner of the lottery, that Powerball lottery, that she can now remain anonymous. We do know her town, though. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can email exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Everyone could do with a bit of Irish luck now and again, which is why you should support NHPR today. When you do, you'll get not one, but two chances to win a trip to Dublin, Ireland, courtesy of Milne Travel American Express. That's two chances to see the brilliant Cliffs of Moher, stroll through St. Stephen's Green, or drink in some knowledge at the Old Jameson Distillery. The lucky winner will be picked on St. Paddy's Day, but you can increase your odds now with your gift today at nhpr.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with NHPR's Dan Tuohy, Gary Reno of InDepthNH.org, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital. Give us a call to join the conversation about the week's news. We'd love to hear from you if you've got questions or comments. The number is 1-800-892-6477. This week, a jury in the trial of a woman who had dozens of sick Great Danes living in her New Hampshire mansion. The jury convicted her of 17 counts of animal cruelty. This is the trial of Christina Fey. Dean, what do you make of this?
Yeah, not a great surprise. As you mentioned, Christina Fey had an earlier lower court bench trial in which the judge found her guilty of a similar number of misdemeanors and ordered her to pay about $800,000 to cover the cost of care. She appealed. She wanted a jury trial. She got one at the Superior Court. That jury also convicted her of 17 counts of animal cruelty misdemeanors. She may be able to appeal to the Supreme Court. I'm not entirely sure on the legality of the challenge, and we haven't heard yet what they plan to do. Episode with the 70 or 80 Great Danes combined with a couple of episodes with large numbers of German Shepherds is starting to kind of spur a rethinking of the licensing and regulations surrounding, you know, commercial and amateur breeding. So we'll see if some good comes of this down the road. But this was a very tragic situation for those dogs who are now being cared for elsewhere. So we'll see what she does. Given what we've seen in the coverage of this, does not seem like a big surprise to me. And I believe the jury even got to tour the home where the dogs were kept as part of this.
Yeah, that was reported several weeks ago, and the article on it this week was very short. So maybe speaking to the fact that this is not a terribly huge surprise. Another story this week having to do with legal matters is the story of Jane Doe. She won the $560 million Powerball lottery, New Hampshire resident, and she had been asking to remain anonymous. Dan Tuohy, why was Jane Doe asking to remain anonymous in the first place?
Well, she won a little over half $1 billion. So her argument was that, you know, she has a right to privacy because of for safety even. That she'd be all these scam artists coming after her. So the court, Judge Temple, concluded that there is a right to privacy so that, you know, press or the public cannot file a request under the right to know law to get her name, which she did sign on the back of her ticket. But the judge did rule, interestingly enough, that we know her town, and she lives in the town of Merrimack, New Hampshire, population 25,000. So we do know that, but really, like, there was some debate online immediately, like, what does this mean for cases going forward? Yes, $560 million is a huge jackpot, but what about what if we've got just a middling $1 million? So there's also a case there that one could argue that they don't want to have their name or identity released for the similar purpose. So we wonder, going forward here, what precedent this might establish.
Gary?
What happened is, I don't know, it's probably about a decade ago or so, we had a winner over in Rochester, and we wanted to remain anonymous. And as a result, the legislature took up the issue. And as often happens, the legislature can complicate things instead of simplify them sometimes. And so they basically said, if you sign the back of the ticket, then you have to be, you can be, your name can be released. If you don't sign the back of the ticket, you can create a trust, and you can hide behind the trust. And she made the mistake of signing the ticket. If she hadn't signed the ticket, this whole thing wouldn't be an issue. She wouldn't have to go to court. She could have created a trust, much like the woman or the person down in Raymond did when we had the last huge winner here in New Hampshire. So that's why it's in court. It's because she signed a ticket. It's not because she really had to come forward. If she could have created a trust, and that wouldn't have been an issue at all.
Mm-hmm. Which is why the state said there was a compelling interest in releasing the name of her town, sure, because that's not an identifying thing. But her name, there's no legal requirement that she release her name. Therefore, it would be an unusual breach of privacy. Dean?
But the problem is, I haven't looked at the back of a lotto ticket in a while, but you're instructed to sign the ticket so that no one else can have it. I don't think it has a whole clause about how, unless you want to remain anonymous, in that case, contact a lawyer and set up a trust. So this is really, there's sort of an education component to this where people can, well, perhaps now learn from this. I've mentioned before, there's a burgeoning industry of lawyers who deal specifically with large jackpots, exactly. So who gets to hold the giant check up? So I think it's a concern for people. You hear all kinds of really sad stories about jackpot winners who've been preyed upon by unscrupulous individuals. And I think the judge ruled that this would be, you know, we're talking, I think she cleared something like $320 million or something like that after taxes. And so that makes you a target.
Yeah, and the state of New Hampshire's position has been and is that, you know, there's transparency issues here. They want to make sure that everything's above board. And even I believe it was 2 years ago, the former governor, Governor Hassan at the time, vetoed a bill that would provide just for this avenue. It's really remarkable when you look at it. Like, it wasn't that long ago.
Wait, what would that bill have vetoed?
It was to provide, you know, someone not to remain anonymous.
Essentially, you can't use a trust?
No, you could use a trust, but, I mean, it was one of those things where the intent of the bill was to allow people to
shield
review from a public records request.
I see.
And, you know, another takeaway here, that the top 10 jackpots won in New Hampshire, of those jackpots, five of them have been claimed by trusts, not by an individual.
Hmm. So you got to wonder if the State Lottery Commission will now revise the instructions they have on the back of the ticket. I don't know if anybody's heard of any intent on the part of the state to do that, but it seems like now it might be a good idea.
Certainly be helpful for people if that's the concern.
So long as that's the law.
As Dean mentioned, you read the back of these tickets there. It's a fine print there. Yeah. I sign my tickets. So
yeah, if you win $500 million, you're going to read that fine print, guarantee you. We've got a few more stories to talk about before the end of this roundup. One of them is that President Donald Trump is coming to New Hampshire. Gary, what's he going to be doing here?
Well, ostensibly, he's supposedly going to be appearing at the Manchester Community College and also at the Manchester Central Fire Station. He's going to be talking about opioids. He made it a big issue when he was running, and he's come under a lot of fire for actually acting very slowly on it, particularly from the senators here in New Hampshire, both of whom said, you know, we need the money released. He hasn't really done a lot to bring in more money, which is what he had sort of said he would do. So he is going to announce the major initiative on the fight for against opioids while he's here in New Hampshire. Ostensibly, part of that is supposed to be the death penalty for dealers. Hmm. And he's going to Central Fire Station because that's the home, the original place for the Safe Station program, where addicts can go in and say, I need help, and they'll find you help, and nobody gets turned over to the police and all that.
Mm-hmm. And we know that President Trump is most comfortable out on the stump when he's meeting with first responders. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something he'll be very comfortable doing. There is some controversy over this death penalty for dealers. There's this, you know, longstanding tension between kind of the recovery community and the law enforcement community. I think New Hampshire has worked in recent years to kind of reconcile that tension a little bit. This would move it in the other direction. We'll see what happens. You know, I've talked to a number of people about Trump coming, and he has a tendency to freestyle when he's speaking from the lectern. And so a number of people have joked that he's actually going to sort of get off track and talk about how, well, Hillary Clinton really didn't win New Hampshire in November of 2016. He did, but there was voter fraud, and we're going to end up back around talking about Bill Gardner again. So we'll see if he stays focused on opioids or if he can't help himself and has to talk about how he actually really won New Hampshire over Hillary Clinton.
Dan?
And the death penalty for drug deals is not a new issue as well. It's come up here and there. And I believe former Manchester Mayor Ted Gatz has talked about that as well. Going back to the Central Station, Safe Station was where they headquartered out of the Manchester's fire departments. You know, it was only 10 months ago where Kellyanne Conway and former Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price visited this very same station. So you wonder, like, well, what happened? This has been bubbling for more than a year in terms of what the president would do in his administration to really crack down.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We've been speaking with our guests about the week's news. And in just a moment, we're going to be talking about a judge who has been suspended without pay because of allegations that he submitted fake evaluations of his job performance. The number for you to call is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. One more question about President Trump's visit before we move on, which is that, Senator from Arizona, Jeff Flake, is in the state today. William Kristol of the Weekly Standard, who was said to be considering a primary challenge to the president, was going to be here this week, but he had to cancel because of the snowstorm. So Jeff Flake also, by the way, considering a primary challenge to the president. So is the president's timing to his visit here in New Hampshire sort of mindful of the fact that he might have some primary competition in New Hampshire? Dean?
Perhaps. Jeff Flake's an interesting case because he obviously is not running for re-election in Arizona. He said he doesn't think he could be elected in the current Republican Party. He has said that he thinks that President Trump should be primaried by someone, whether it will be him or maybe John Kasich or somebody else, we don't know. He has been highly critical of the president and of the direction of the Republican Party. So I don't think this is the last we will have heard of Jeff Flake. He's been increasingly visible talking about his concerns about Trump and about the Republican Party.
Okay. Being sure to be big news on Monday when the president visits New Hampshire. A New Hampshire circuit court judge has been suspended without pay because allegedly he submitted fake evaluations for his job performance. Gary, who is this judge?
It's Judge Paul Moore. He was appointed quite a while ago, actually. I think it's better than 10 years or so ago.
Yeah. Why did he say he did this?
Well, he said he was obsessed with his evaluations, that he became very obsessed with getting very good numbers. And he was basically submitting all these evaluations of himself with perfect numbers, perfect scores, and by anonymous people. So they have some sort of evaluation system, electronic evaluation system, for the court judges at the court system, administrative court system does. And he was saying that he was doing a lot of these online, some of them actually from his office, others at his home and his own computer. And he was suspended quite a while ago. And it just came out recently that this is what he was suspended for.
Mm-hmm. And so what's the next step in this?
The AG, the Attorney General's office, is going to investigate. I believe that the Judicial Conduct Committee has already sort of checked in and has suspended him. Well, it's up to the court to do that. So we'll see what happens. But there are a couple of other, I mean, there's more to go through the judicial conduct system, but also the AG is investigating. So there are kind of two avenues going on here at the same time.
I see. All right. Well, that should wrap up the week's news, although there was much more to cover. We ran out of time, but let me ask each of you in the waning seconds what you think you'll be looking at in the coming week. We'll start with you, Gary. What are you going to be covering?
Well, I'm not going to sure how much I'll be covering, but next week is a crossover at the State House, so there'll be a lot of, as they always do, they leave lots of good stuff till the end. So there'll be all sorts of good bills to be looking into.
Dan?
Yeah, I should clarify. I guess Mayor Gatsas talked about state law being changed to allow drug dealers selling fentanyl to be charged with attempted murder. Next week I'll be looking at, again, crossover as well.
Crossover week. Okay, how about you, Dean?
Big week. You know, it's a big weekend for presidential politics. Jeff Flake today. Tomorrow, Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley is here to talk about gerrymandering. And then we have President Trump coming on Monday. So lots of presidential stuff percolating up.
That is Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website NH Political Capital. We also had NHPR's Dan Tuohy and Gary Reno of InDepthNH.org filling us in on the details of the week's news. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for being here.
Thanks, Peter.
You're welcome, Peter.
Remember, this conversation continues online. You can find links to all the stories that we discussed today at NHPR.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Theme music by Bob Lord. And I am Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.